FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It is September 17th, 2017, recovering from storm-ravaged South Florida. So what happened in Benghazi back in 2012, September 11th, 2012? I've never been real comfortable with it. Never thought we got the true story. And now it appears that the real story is coming out. And if you haven't heard this yet, it's really amazing. Rather than say it in my words, I've got Brad Owens. Brad, you're former Army intelligence officer. You were on the ground in Benghazi in 2012, and the story started coming out. You worked for a company by the name of Terez Advanced Enterprise Solutions, which provides private security to the U.S. State Department facilities around the globe. So welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Kerry. Thanks for letting me come on and tell our story.
Hey, well, it's quite a story, and it's one that shows, I don't know what it shows here, but it's certainly interesting. So basically, your company bid on this contract to guard this facility, because I don't know what it really was, and nobody seems to want to talk about what it really was, but some type of State Department facility, and just tell us what happened. Your company puts in the bid, and then what?
Well, let me give you just a little bit of background so that, sure, you know, for a little bit of depth, so that your listeners understand. Jerry Torres, who founded Torres Advanced Enterprise Systems, Torres AES, is a former Green Beret. He was a door kicker. He was a team leader on the ground in Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, Horn of Africa. And he founded this company after getting injured in Afghanistan and started picking up contracts. First, he started off as providing linguists and translators and interrogators, which spread into security, armed security in Iraq, Afghanistan, and now just, you know, South America, all over. So pretty large company of about 6,000 employees. But this is, our focus has been diplomatic security, embassy-related security, that sort of thing for several years now, probably 7 years, 8 years. And we got quite a few embassies and consulates that we guard around the world. Some are armed, some are not. I had convinced Jerry, I was the director of African operations, and I convinced Jerry to let me take a team into Libya in about the middle of 2011. The war was still going on. Tripoli had just fell. And so we kind of wanted, as we say in the military, lean forward at the foxhole, you know, get ahead of this, because there's a lot of support necessary, you know, in post-conflict, post-disaster areas. So we were there on the ground and developed a relationship with Eric Nordstrom, who is a regional security officer who was in charge of security for all of Libya with the State Department. And we're just helping them out on some things, waiting for the, you know, bids to come out, any tenders to come out. Fast forward to, you know, through the summer, through the fall of 2011, the security situation in Libya just deteriorated. After Gaddafi was killed and his sons were captured, or one was killed, one was captured, they basically, the security situation, the Khatibas, which are mostly started fighting each other for power, is, you know, to make it an overly simplified explanation of what was going on. And they had started attacking Western missions. And so the security situation is getting, you know, much more dangerous. And so the explanation we were given as to what this compound was to be a consulate in case they had to evacuate Tripoli. This was supposed to be where the team in Tripoli, the ambassador and his folks, moved there so that they could maintain a, you know, a presence on the ground. We assumed it was because that would be seen as a policy failure if, like, they had to pull out. You know, but the Brits had pulled out. By the time of the attacks on Benghazi, the Brits had been out for a while. But they had been directly attacked as well. So, yeah, fast forward to the bid. I was in another country. I believe I was in Zambia in southern Africa. We had won that embassy contract, and I was there helping get it started up. And this tender came out for Benghazi. So I returned to Libya and did a site visit at the compound. And so they allow you to do that if you're going to bid, because, you know, that way you can see physically what you're getting yourself into and properly prepare your proposal. I mean, I was the only person to do the site visit. There was no one else there except me. So I, you know, walked through. We submitted our tender. We were the only people that, that submitted a proposal for it the first go round. When we first arrived in 2011, one of the first things we do, because the State Department requires you to adhere to all local security laws if you're going to work for them on the ground. So we would have to have had a security license in Libya to bid on anything. There was only three security companies before the regime fell. There was one left standing, and it was a guy that owned a few luxury hotels. He just created it to guard his own hotels. So we had a teaming agreement with Atlas Security. And so we tendered for it, and it got kicked back. The contract department said it had to, you know, had to have more than one bid. So all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes this smaller company called Blue Mountain. We, you know, we'd never really heard of Blue Mountain. They had a couple guys on the ground in Tripoli, but helping the Canadians, I believe it was. But, you know, no serious presence there. Certainly no background like ours, you know, with the Department of Defense and DOS. So they won it because there's a law that was passed in 1990 that requires these types of contracts to go to the lowest bidder that is technically acceptable. So for your listeners to understand, that means you have to, as long as you meet the absolute minimum technical capability to do the minimum on the contract and you're the low bidder, you get it. So it's not the best company for the job. It's not who's going to do the best job. It's who makes the minimum standards and is a low bidder. They beat us on the rebid by 4 percentage points. Very small amount of money. If you divide it, it was a one-year contract. You divide it over the year. It basically was that they were about $50 less per day than we were to guard the embassy. So it was a smaller contract. It was only worth about $750,000 for the year. So we, you know, we decided not to challenge it. We had Paraguay. We had won several other embassies that were being stood up. So we just said, okay, we'll take a bite at the apple next year when it's back out. Okay, fast forward 6 months. Okay, this is 12 days before the attacks on the embassy where Ambassador Stevens, Smith, Doherty, and Woods were killed. And I always like to say their names because I don't want them to be cardboard cutouts. You know, these are real people that died. Before the four individuals were killed, we were asked to come in. And what happened was we had won Pakistan, and we were having some meetings at the State Department in Roslyn, Virginia. They have a building there. And our director of operations got pulled out of that by Jan Vissentainer. Now, Jan Vissentainer was the Near East desk officer, or not Near East desk, but she was the person in charge over the security contracts in that region. And she, you know, had basically pulled our guy out and said, look, could y'all perform in Libya? Well, that should tell your listeners a couple of things. One is that they knew the security was completely inadequate. Now, later on, we found out that it had completely disintegrated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that they were in a, you know, they knew that there was no adequate security there. So I got called. I got my teams started getting together. Our director of operations called the State Department every single day saying, hey, green light, yes, no. And they said, stalled, wait. 12 days later, we all know what happens. So after that, things just went quiet.
So, hey, questions for you. First of all, how long would it have taken you to deploy in that embassy? Because obviously, or whatever, the facility, because obviously you can't just walk in there on a day's notice, right?
Well, two things would have had to happen. They would have had to give us what's called a notice to proceed. That would be the official letter saying, hey, you guys are to step in here. Once I had that, I would have a six-man former Special Forces team. That was who we proposed, would have been on the ground in about 48 hours. Those six guys, along with myself, would have begun the logistics of transferring it from one company to us. That takes about, and because it was such a small contract, there was not a lot of equipment, there was not a lot of stuff related to it, it would have been about a 30-day transition. So it would have been from the time they said go to the time we stood up would have probably been less than 1 month.
Mm-hmm. Hey, so, and then you said you actually toured that facility before.
Yes, sir. I was on that compound twice.
So what was going on there? I mean, you must have noticed glaring security lapses there, I would think, right?
Well, yes. Well, a couple of things, yes and no. Here's the thing. First off, it was pretty much unoccupied. Now the annex that everybody hears about, the CIA annex, was a different area. It wasn't this the backup consulate, is what it was called, or the consulate. And basically what it was a nice, you know, upper middle class, I would say even mansion-like house on a very large compound with very high walls around it. It had several gate entrances. There was one that was closer to the house. They used to rent both sides of the compound. They gave up one side, and there was a hole in the wall there that they put a door in. But there was a road on one side, and then in the corner facing the house on the backside, there was kind of like a little guard shack block house. right? Which is pretty common in this part of the world. And that was where the 17th Martyr Brigade guys were. That was a local Libyan Fatiba who had been hired directly by the State Department in the interim to provide security for the compound. There was only one diplomatic security service agent there and maybe a handful of staff, maybe three or four people. So it wasn't really functioning as anything, but it was, you know, it was capable. As far as the security goes, actually, if you'd had the right people there, and you'd had reinforced the gate and had some key things like some cameras and some stuff like that, it wouldn't have been that bad, that hard to defend it. It's got pretty high walls, concrete reinforced, rebar reinforced concrete. The house itself, most of the houses there are built out of concrete. So yeah. with the right team there and the right equipment, it would have been very defendable, even against a pretty good attack. The problem was they didn't have enough manpower. It was a very large compound. Mm-hmm. And, so that was one of the big lapses. They didn't put enough people there. But, you know, it was very much lacking when compared to other embassies. And especially to be in a high threat area, it was extremely lacking in what it needed.
Yeah, so you like picked up on that right away, I would think, huh?
Absolutely. That was my job. That's what I do. When I go there, I do what's called a site security survey for my company, which means I go through and I annotate everything that would be needed to bring it up to our minimum standards to provide the security according to the contract. And there's a list of things. And I had, you know, I still have my handwritten notes from the visit. I keep everything. I'm a former military intelligence guy. So, of course, I keep everything. One of the reasons this story was able to be told is because I keep every single email I'm ever sent, and I was able to produce emails and give exact dates and times and names of who was there and what they were asking us to do and those sort of things. So it was definitely needed a lot of work. So yeah, that's my job is to put the plan together so that we can take over the contract and do it effectively.
Right. And then, so no explanation. Where did this Welsh company come from? It sounds like some kind of setup deal. I mean, I'm not saying anything unforward happened, but it's suspicious, isn't it?
Well, first off, there's a few things that were problems with the contract. And here's the thing, you know, hindsight's always perfect clarity, but these contracts they're called LGF, Local Guard Force contracts, and they have some specific rules that they put in place, one of which is you're supposed to bid in U.S. dollars or local currency. That prevents any sort of, you know, manipulation based off of exchange rate differences between the time you put the bid in and when it's actually awarded, if you understand what I'm saying.
Sure.
They bid in British pounds. As a matter of fact, the notice that we got that we did not win shows what they bid in British pounds. So that was one problem. They should have been disqualified immediately because of that. Secondly, it's not an American company. We are. We're supposed to have a 10% bid advantage in any contract we bid on with State Department with these types of contracts. We only lost by 4%. The contracting officer, Jan Vissentainer, told us, because I asked about it, told us, and our executives were asking, was it's her discretion whether or not to apply that. But it's not. It's actually in the law. It's in the 1990 law that says we get this preference. So that should have been a disqualifier, and it wasn't. And the other piece of it was Blue Mountain, UK, did not have a security license to operate on the ground in Libya. What they had was they created a local partner called Blue Mountain Libya, and they got a local fixer who, if the State Department, when they were vetting these guys, had just Googled the local partner's name, they would have found out that he had been unceremoniously fired by Unaoil, a large company, who wanted to do business in Libya because he got caught suggesting that they pay bribes to the Gaddafi regime to get the contracts they wanted for the oil. Now, they didn't fire him for doing that, but they fired him after WikiLeaks released the emails and showed he was encouraging their executives to pay the bribes. So you have a known guy who's involved with corruption on the ground. He somehow finagles a letter to operate from the National Transitional Council. They didn't have a seated government at this time. Exactly. It was just this council. And so there's three things right there that the State Department, had they done anything correctly, it would have been a situation where there was a where they could have been a, you know, something could have happened, right? Mm-hmm. That would have, like, we would have gotten it. And I can tell you right now, if you look at our technical proposal, what we put forward about how we would actually do it, you know, the Ambassador Stevens and those men would still be alive today had we gotten that contract, because we would have had the right team on the ground.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you would have, when you saw the situation deteriorating, regardless what the contract said, you were going to put out a call for more support, right?
Well, here's what we did. You know, this contract, believe it or not, and this is one of the most amazing, it was let as an unarmed contract. In other words, the guards were not supposed to be armed. And the State Department contracting officers, Jan Vicentainer and Sharon James, who actually, you know, put the proposal forward or put the request proposal forward, they actually made it an unarmed contract. Now, you know, we were going to bid on it, but the way we were going to handle it was this. We weren't going to use the local militia guys to recruit from, which is what Blue Mountain did. We had our own guys who'd been working with at Tripoli that were UK expatriates. You know, they had been, from the United States. We had some guys that were from UAE and Europe that we had worked with and trained and had a good relationship with. So we were going to bring our guys from Tripoli to come to the compound and guard it with us. Now, we were going to bring about 20 guys with us. All of these guys were former militia members, which were authorized to have weapons. So what we were going to do is we had a compound half a kilometer from the compound that they rented. It was going to be our base of operations. We'd had about half an A team of American folks there, plus our 20 guys. They would not be living in the community. They would have been living on our compound with us. They would have had their weapons there as part of a quick reaction force, which was asked for in the contract. We have a mobile patrol with a quick reaction force. Now, we would not have had guns on the regular patrols, but had an attack took place, obviously we would have, you know, disregarded the not be armed order, handed out the rifles and counterattacked or did some sort of defense. That's the reason. That's what we do. This is what we do. You know, this is the type of work we do around the world. So we're prepared for that. So if you add a half of Special Forces A team, six men there, plus me, plus the 20 local guys we work with and train, that's a pretty formidable force. I mean, that's, you know, a light platoon right there.
Right. And battle hardened, battle tested. So, you know, you knew what you were
absolutely
doing. Absolutely. Do you think Jan Vicentainer feels any responsibility for this whole thing?
Well, I think she knew she was responsible for it, a lot of it, because if you fast forward past the attacks several months later, Jerry Tor, you know, and Jerry, like I said, he's a retired Green Beret. He was a door kicker. He's a great guy. He likes to be downrange. So he's always out, you know, he's in South America right now. He's not even in the U.S. As soon as the interview was over on Tucker Carlson, he got out of town and went back to working on contracts overseas. So Jerry gets called back to the State Department, and these guys that manage these contracts can order our CEOs around. Like, we have a contract with it. If whoever the contracting officer is, they could summon our CEO to their office. Mm-hmm. And they did that. So they call him back. They didn't tell him what it was about. Usually you have to bring paperwork, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And the situation is that he got there, and he flew all the way back. I think he was in Greece, and he flew back. And he goes to this meeting, and there was nothing of substance discussed. It was just kind of a meet and greet, and they talked about some of the issues and things. So he got ready to leave, and Jan Vicentainer was escorting him out of the building. And so he gets right before he gets to security, she pulls him aside and says, "Hey, Jerry, I need to talk to you about something." And he says, "Okay." She says, "Listen, I need you. We really need you to be in lockstep with us on this Benghazi thing." And you know, at first, Jerry said he didn't know really. You know, he's kind of like, "What do you mean, Benghazi?" You know, he hadn't really thought about it in a while. And she said, "Listen, don't talk to the press and don't talk to anyone looking into this. And, we really would appreciate that." And he said, he didn't know what to say. He's just standing there. So she went on, and here's where it gets really dirty. And this is very much an implied threat. She said, "Look, you guys are winning a lot of contracts with us, and we'd like to keep it that way. You're doing a good job. So, we need you to be a team player on this thing. Okay. Don't talk to anybody, and don't let anybody know we were talking to you about the contract." Okay. He's standing there. He doesn't say anything. And then she adds this to the end of it, which was insult to injury, which says, "But if you have to talk to somebody, you know, we'd like you to stick with us on our,
we'd like you to lie.
It should not have been armed." Yeah. It shouldn't have been armed.
Right.
So, he walks out. He did not commit yes or no. He walks out and he gave me a call. Almost immediately he called him. He got back to the office. And I was still the director of African operations at the time. He said, "Hey, listen to this." And he tells me the story. And I was like, "Well, Jerry, that's unethical. I mean, she can't, and I'm sorry. I'm a kind of a Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of guy, I guess, in some respects." Mm-hmm. I was like, "Well, why wouldn't the government want like the truth out there? Why would they tell us not to I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Well, obviously, that's an admission there's something to hide. You know, I'm a military intelligence guy. I figured it out, but it was very bizarre. You know, it was very bizarre. Mm-hmm. It's completely inappropriate and unethical. And yeah, given the fact
probably that criminal died, too. Probably criminal it,
well,
too.
I would hope so, but it's immoral. At a very minimum, it's immoral to like, you know, it's like people's lives have no value to them. You know what I mean? Like we're just throw away, you know, cards or something.
It's definitely criminal because she's basically asking you to lie before Congress. I mean,
well, see, she was smart though. She didn't say Congress. Mm. She said officials. That was the way I think she phrased it. She didn't say don't talk to Congress because she'd be nailed on that one. Yeah. Now, fast forward to now. Why are we coming forward now? We've been getting a lot of questions about why we come forward now. There's a couple of very key reasons. One of which is, you know, we have a new administration. We believe that now, because the politics have been taken out of it, you know, Secretary Clinton's no longer a candidate, that we hope that we'll get some traction on actually changing the rules that allowed this comedy of errors and incompetence and negligence to lead to the deaths of four of our folks. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is draw attention to the rule that the 1990 log, if you look at the world in 1990 and you come 27 years forward, who could say that the world of 1990, its threat posture wise and threats to our embassies and threats around the world, are anywhere near the same type or the same scope?
Yeah.
You know, today is a different world and we need to adjust the law. Our main problem is that no one was ever held accountable. That's the problem. Kerry, not one single person was fired over the people being killed.
And she's still there, this person, right? Jan Vicentainer,
well,
right?
Oh, it's even worse. Yeah, no, not only is she not fired.
She got promoted, right? I'm sure she got promoted.
She got promoted.
I knew you were going to say that.
Still in the same department. Kerry, would you believe they're still in the same department, still making decisions over security contracts out there in this world that deal with diplomatic security, and they made all of these mistakes. Now, I would also like to point out that there's a human side of this for me. I've done these types of contracts. I've been overseas for years. I've spent more than half of my adult life living overseas. And you know what? That could have been me.
Yeah.
And I think about my daughter. I think about my wife, my mom, dad. I think
That's
about
horrible.
My family.
There's no excuse for
and,
this.
There's, I mean, do our you know, I do our lives have value? You know, because I like to think when I'm downrange.
They do to us. Not to the government, but to us they do.
Yeah. It's amazing to me how I think the lack of respect for the sanctity of life kind of plays into how people can just throw us away. But to them, we're just a bunch of knuckle-dragging troglodytes. You know, that's the way they look at us. We're just security guys, and who cares? But the reality is that, you know, the policies, there was some policy mistakes here, too. The soft power policy, which led to a lot of these contracts being stripped of their weapons, and so we did present a more aggressive image, you know, as part of the problem, too.
Oh, sure.
I'll give you an example. Same people, Jan Vicentainer, Sharon James, these guys, asked us to voluntarily disarm Panama and Peru, which is two other embassies that we have. We refused, of course, which, again, put a target on our back. Because we wouldn't cooperate, wouldn't play ball, you know.
And now
we
they're
think
not,
all of the
yeah.
contracts, yeah. No, we just think they should all be armed. I mean,
right,
it's just
of course.
A simple security
ridiculous.
Measure.
And now they're not giving you contracts, right? They've given you very few contracts in the past year, I read.
It's actually pretty interesting because what we figured out was because they basically started retaliating against us, right? Hmm. There was a shift to, you know, we were, you know, basically, we've been blackballed without due process. And what's happened is we were winning about 8 out of 10 of these we were bidding on before this happened, this incident in Benghazi and these people. And so now we've been, we've lost 18 out of the last 20 we've won. And the only two we won were we were already the incumbent for 5 years.
Right.
And they just simply couldn't find a way to get us out. But I'll give you a couple of quick examples of how they can run a company out of business if they tried. Now, we're a larger company. We have deeper pockets. And so this doesn't work on us, but it would work on a smaller company. we had some, after this started happening, some of the contracting officers that Biss and Tainer controlled started nitpicking every single little thing we were doing. You know, they can fine us, right. They can give us a fine for here and there. So we ended up in Argentina with $1.9 million worth of fines, and they withheld payment for over 2 years. So we had to float the entire cost of over 300 guards that are armed in Argentina for almost 2 years and fight the fines. Now, after Vicentino was shifted to a different position, there was a new contracting officer to replace the old one. He took a look at it, dismissed the fines, and paid us the money. 2 weeks after that, the guy was gone. He was moved to a different position.
Really?
True story. That's in Argentina. Paraguay. Paraguay was our regional headquarters in South America. We just rebid it this past year, and we were $2 million the low bid, and they disqualified us on a technical. And what they did was, you get evaluated every year, right? Because these are basically one-year contracts with four extensions, so it's a five-year contract. So you get evaluated every year, and that goes, goes out. We got very good. There's like superior, very good, okay, satisfactory, and then needs improvement kind of thing. There's several categories. So in Paraguay, you're supposed to use the one that's on the record, the one from the previous year or whatever's on the record when you evaluate. They did an out-of-cycle evaluation and evaluated us on basically 3 months, okay, and filed that. And what they did was, before they did that, they went through and they dinged us on every single little thing you could possibly ding us on, bam, 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 bam. And so that evaluation was a negative one. So we were judged. Every other one was perfect, exceeded all expectations. So we were graded on 1.8% of the time instead of the 98.2% of the time, and we lost the contract. So we're $2 million the low bid, and they finagled. So this is the type of power these contracting officers have.
Sure.
And so if we were a smaller company, or we were borrowing money, or had to be bonded out on these things, you'd have been out of business a long time ago. And I still believe that's what they're trying to do, is to get us out so we'll have no platform, we'll have no credibility, and no ability to fight back. So, these are some of the things that, you can see with these guys. I mean, and I could actually go on and on. There's list after list of things, Pat, but I won't bore the audience with, nitpicking stuff. But the point is, they screwed up by picking the wrong company. They asked us the right company to come back. It was too late. The folks were killed. Then they asked us to cover it up with them, which we didn't do, but they have no way of knowing if we testify behind closed doors or not. So they must have assumed that we would, that we did. And so they've been on this systematic campaign ever since to try to run us out of business. And we're still strong. I mean, they're not succeeding. But now that we had a change of administration with the five-year mark, Jerry sat me down and he said, look, we need to come forward. He said, we've got to tell the truth and try to get some justice for these guys and try to get the people that are, a big part of the reason it happened, held accountable finally.
Yeah,
the other piece of it is, we're trying to get Congress to change that law and go, when it comes to security, go with best value. Get rid of this stupid, rule that makes them, the race to the bottom, we call it.
Well,
There's
a thing called lowest responsible bidder when you're bidding on government contracts. And clearly this Blue Mountain company was not a responsible bidder. I mean, it's on its face. They had no pedigree, no experience, and it looks like they were a friend of somebody who just got put in there. And, that's what it looks like to me, knowing the way the government works.
Well, I would like to know the answer to that. And there's people who know. The question is, why haven't those questions been answered? And, the whole investigation was politicized. We know that. You had Clinton supporters on one side because she's going to run for president, Stonewall. And on the other side, you had Republicans that want to do as much damage as possible. So that's one of the problems I have with both sides of this argument, or both sides of it, is because I've been criticized now by both. Up until Clinton ran for president, I was a Democrat. I've been a member of the Democratic Party. I was a Democratic officer in the party. I was my county treasurer for years and president of the Young Democrats when I was younger. And so for me, this did a lot more than just, it really took like my view of what I believed in for a lot of years and shook it to its core. This isn't right. People's lives have intrinsic value. And you know, to not to know that, this I'm one of these guys that, you know, the type of dude that I work that got killed, mm-hmm. and that my life is of so little value to people like Hillary Clinton that I'm just a card to be thrown in a political game. And then on the other side, you got the Republicans mm-hmm. who, for whatever reason, didn't fully investigate this. I mean, yeah. we were never called. Our name was on the actual paperwork. We submitted bids. These emails are out there.
And
I've never understood why we weren't called.
And you had been there yourself. Nobody knew more about the situation there. Granted, it changed, but nobody knew more about the security requirements of that facility than you. You'd been there twice. You'd prepared a contract bidding on it. I'd say that gives you a little bit more credibility than anybody else as far as being an armchair quarterback here. Right? It's just, it's mind-boggling. But it doesn't surprise me in the least.
Well, I want to tell you something interesting that's happened since, and I want to encourage your listeners mm-hmm. to do a couple of things. One of which is, if they haven't read the piece that Catherine Herridge and Pamela yeah. K. Brown and Sydenham did, visit the Fox News website and just, you know, search for it and read the entire article. Watch the Tucker Carlson piece where we're being interviewed. Get informed on it. And then reach out to your member of Congress, to your senator, call them and say, look, get into this. We need a proper investigation because, you know, I'll give you another policy interesting thing, right? I don't do policy. You know, I'm on the ground implementing policy. I'm not, you know. Right. So for me, you know, these are the guys that we depend on to actually keep oversight on all of these situations. So our Congress needs to look at why it happened, not who, you know, look at how the opportunity for these guys to attack the embassy and be successful happened and right. close those gaps. Because there's a few things they could do. They could get rid of that 1990 law when it comes to security for these contracts. That would be a good fix. But these people at the State Department deserve to be fired.
Yeah.
Okay. These people don't deserve to be in these positions with blood on their hands, making mm-hmm. decisions that still affect good people downrange. And if they want us to be unarmed in these situations, then they need to realize that we're not diplomats. Our role in this, they fundamentally right. misunderstand the role of security. Our role in this is to provide an obstacle between bad actors who want to kill our people and the opportunity to do it. That's the key.
That's it.
Right?
That's it. You're
take
muscle.
Away their opportunity.
you
want the hardest target.
Yeah. You're muscle, let's face it. I mean, you're there to protect.
Right.
And
well, let me, you know, we always use this example when I train people. I say, look, you want to present the hardest target. A professional security person never does anything for no reason. Okay. Everything we do has purpose behind it on the job.
Of course.
And a wolf doesn't attack another wolf. The wolf looks for the sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to be the wolf. And the only time they'll attack each other is when there's no more sheep around.
Yeah.
And we'll take them on nose to nose. We don't have a problem taking them on nose to nose. But don't make me a sheep. Don't make batons against machine guns be the way we fight this, because that shows a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of security here. We're not diplomats. We're there to make sure they can go do their job.
Yeah.
But it's
madness.
So I would encourage listeners.
Madness.
Now, I will say this. There is a little bit of a bright spot on this. The very next morning after the article ran, we were contacted by a Senate committee and a House committee. Both sides contacted uh-huh. immediately after the story ran. And there's some folks that want to come in. They want us to come in. They want to talk to us. They want to look into this. So I will not hold my breath that these bulletproof middle management bureaucrats that are the swamp, that are the deep state, will be held accountable.
Talk about
but at
swamp,
least,
huh?
Yeah, but at least we'll be able to tell our side of the story, you know, what happened, our part of the story, and hopefully that'll lead them down a path that they get something done so it'll be less likely to happen again.
Brad, your part of the story is the story. Let's face it. Everything else is CYA garbage. Your part of the story is really, A, it was preventable. B, you had incompetent bureaucrats. C, there's some hanky-panky going on there in the awarding of the contract. We know that. I mean, come on. Like you said, they bid in British pounds. They didn't bid in U.S. dollars. So how could it be otherwise, right? I mean, come on. So
that's it.
Anyways, Brad, people want to find out more about you, what you're doing on this. Is there a place they can go?
Well, what we're doing now, the response has been overwhelming, Kerry. It's been amazing. And there's so many people out there that really care about this. So what we're going to do is we're going to set up a website, kind of a clearinghouse for the information. But right now, if people could just keep an eye on our company website, we're going to post a link to it when we get it up. We're trying to figure out how to best do it. But it's Toresco.com is our website. So it's TORRESCO.com, Toresco.com. And that's our company. And you can learn more about the company there. So you can see that, you know, we have credibility. This is the type of work we do, you know, and we're lots of places in the world. So you get to know us and then we'll keep people posted on it. I'd love to, if something else comes up or these investigations go somewhere, would love to come back and tell you more about it.
Absolutely. We want to hear. Appreciate you coming on. Hey, any questions, comments, this episode, any others we do, KL@KerryLutz.com. The Twitter feed's @KerryLutz. This will be posted to it. Don't hesitate to tweet us. And the Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. Brad, really appreciate you coming on, giving us the story here, giving us the true story. We'll talk to you again real soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kerry.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.